Hey guys, this right here is going to be PALS, the Pediatric Advanced Life Support. And the way it's going to go is I'm going to try to keep it in this order. The systematic approach to the pediatric patients, pediatric shock recognition, pediatric management of shock, recognizing respiratory distress, managing respiratory distress, recognizing cardiac arrest, management of cardiac arrest, arrhythmias, recognition of those arrhythmias, and then management of those arrhythmias. I don't remember PALS being this deep, but again, it's been almost 2 years since I've taken PALS, but it seems like it's a lot more in depth than just your normal ACLS. So this material is coming straight from the book for the course. Just make sure that you guys are reading that material because I did not add some stuff in there like team dynamics or resources for respiratory care or management of the post-cardiac arrest, you know, stuff like that. I didn't include that into this stuff. So if you guys need that or want that, then by all means, read the book or you know, Google it or whatever. But this right here is going to be the intro for the PALS stuff. So I hope you guys enjoy the Pediatric Advanced Life Support material for the course.
Patient's here. Oh boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, there's definitely blood.
Well, he's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in the top of the vehicle, or was caved in, so she was hanging out partially from the window.
She had 22 in her left hand.
For 45 minutes of CPR. No we can stop CPR.
6 over.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're embarking on a mission that is, I think, absolutely critical for anyone working in pediatric critical care.
It really is.
Specifically, if you are an ER nurse or a frontline provider and you're currently prepping for your PALS certification, this session is tailored exactly for you.
That's so right. You know, when people approach PALS, their minds, they just jump straight to the code card. You know, the epinephrine, the defibrillator, all the cardiac algorithms.
All right, the exciting stuff.
The exciting stuff, yeah. But when we talk about children, the source material is completely unequivocal. The real success, the difference between a tragic outcome and a successful recovery, it all happens in the minutes before that code blue is ever called.
So we are focusing entirely on prevention today. We're treating this foundational respiratory component of PALS not as a, you know, a checklist to memorize, but as the single most essential clinical skill set you can have.
Exactly.
Our goal here is to move way beyond the textbook definitions and really get into the, well, the severe and often terrifying clinical reasoning and the pathophysiology of how a child deteriorates.
And we've synthesized some core foundational resources that all emphasize one primary truth. In pediatric advanced life support, if you are waiting for that child to enter the cardiac arrest algorithm, you have already you've already squandered that crucial window for the best possible outcome.
So this is all about the run-up.
It's all about the run-up. We are diving deep into the recognition and really the aggressive management of pediatric respiratory distress and failure.
Okay, let's start with that central physiological distinction. What makes pediatric resuscitation so fundamentally different from, say, adult ACLS? Why is the respiratory system always, always the first place we look in a crashing child?
It just boils down to the overwhelming pathway to arrest. Our sources highlight this critical divergence. Adults, you know, they often suffer a primary cardiac event, a sudden arrhythmia, V-fib, maybe massive MI, and that leads directly to circulatory collapse. It's an electrical or a pump problem, first and foremost.
Sure, the heart itself is the primary problem.
Exactly. But children, they have healthier hearts. Their hearts don't just suddenly fail. Their heart fails because it runs out of fuel.
And that fuel is oxygen.
The fuel is oxygen. So children crash overwhelmingly via oxygenation and ventilation failure. That failure leads to profound hypoxemia, then acidosis, and then eventually the myocardium just gives up.
So in pediatrics, the cardiac arrest is almost always a secondary event. It's a consequence, not the cause.
It's the end of the line, not the beginning.
Yeah.
And that distinction implies just a horrifying pace of progression.
Right, because their reserves are so much smaller.
So much smaller. The source material really stresses that this transition from initial distress, where they're compensating, to full cardiac arrest is significantly faster in kids. A compensated child can deteriorate to full circulatory collapse in, a matter of minutes.
Why so fast?
Well, they have fewer metabolic reserves, for one. They have much higher oxygen consumption rates relative to their size. And critically, they have a limited ability to increase their stroke volume.
So they can't pump more blood with each beat as effectively as an adult can.
Exactly. Their main way to compensate for stress is just to increase their heart rate. Tachycardia. That's it. So their compensation is, well, it's tenuous at best.
And this rapid progression, it must dramatically impact their prognosis. I mean, if you intervene during the respiratory failure versus waiting for the full cardiac arrest, what does the data tell us about the outcomes?
The difference is, it's just stark.
Yeah.
And if you take one thing away from this deep dive, this is it. This is the high yield takeaway for anyone getting certified.
Okay.
Good outcomes. And by that, I mean survival with favorable neurological status, are profoundly more likely after an isolated respiratory arrest that you successfully reverse than after a full-blown cardiac arrest that required chest compressions.
Wow.
Once that child develops cardiac arrest stemming from the respiratory problem, the odds of a neurologically intact survival just plummet. They fall off a cliff.
So that is the entire why for the ER nurse. Your whole mission is aggressive intervention during that respiratory distress phase to prevent the heart rate from ever dropping.
Precisely. The moment you see profound, persistent bradycardia setting in, you have to know that the heart muscle itself is exhausted and hypoxic.
Mm.
You are already in the danger zone, and the prognosis has just gotten significantly worse.
We have to catch them while they're still fighting.
We have to catch them while they're still compensating.
Okay, so to do that, to catch them early, we need really clear clinical definitions. What are the definitive signposts that separate respiratory distress from respiratory failure?
The distinction really lies in two main things: the patient's effort and the adequacy of their gas exchange.
Okay, let's start with distress, the early phase.
Right. Respiratory distress is the compensated phase. It's defined by an abnormal respiratory rate or, more importantly, an increased effort. The child is struggling, but they are, for the moment, still managing to maintain acceptable oxygenation and ventilation.
But they're doing it through extreme exertion.
Extreme exertion. Clinically, you're going to see hyperventilation, right? Mm-hmm. Tachypnea, offy with deep breaths. You're going to see that increased use of accessory muscles.
Nasal flaring, the suprasternal or intercostal retractions. I've even seen head bobbing in infants.
Exactly. Head bobbing. They are fighting. And crucially, they're often blowing off CO2 so effectively that their PaCO2 is either low or normal. That tells you they haven't fatigued yet.
They're still winning the fight, just barely.
They are. Now, respiratory failure, on the other hand, is the late decompensated stage. The child has either just completely fatigued, or the underlying pathology is so severe that even their maximum effort can't maintain adequate gas exchange anymore.
So paradoxically, the signs of effort might actually decrease as they get sicker.
Yes. And that is such a critical point. Failure is characterized by abnormal oxygenation or abnormal ventilation, or both. And it progresses from that maximum effort to a decreased effort.
That's the ominous sign.
It's the most ominous sign. Clinically, you see the signs of impending collapse. Altered mental status, maybe some cyanosis, and most critically, a reduction in respiratory effort. That exhaustion is a death knell. They can't move the volume they need. Their PaCO2 starts to climb, and acidosis worsens just rapidly.
Okay, let's drill down into those two fundamental physiological problems we're trying to fix: hypoxemia and hypercarbia. Let's start with hypoxemia, the oxygenation problem.
So hypoxemia is, by definition, low oxygen in the arterial blood. The sources typically define it as an arterial oxygen saturation below 94%, assuming the child is on room air.
Okay, pretty straightforward.
But here's the key nuance we have to hammer home. It's the difference between hypoxemia and tissue hypoxia. They are not the same thing.
Right. This is a classic trap, I think, for providers who rely only on the pulse oximeter. Hypoxemia is low oxygen in the blood, but tissue hypoxia is the actual pathological condition where oxygen delivery to the cells is insufficient for their needs.
Correct. You have to remember the oxygen delivery equation. Delivery, or DO2, isn't just determined by the saturation on the monitor. the SAO2. Oh. It's also determined by the hemoglobin concentration and the cardiac output.
So an anemic child could have a great SAT but still be in trouble.
Profound trouble. As an ER nurse, you have to look beyond the pulse oximeter.
Give us a high-stakes clinical example of that. Paint a picture.
Okay, I'm having two patients. Patient A comes in, their SpO2 is 88%, looks bad on the monitor, but they have a strong pulse, good cap refill, and you know their hemoglobin is high. They're hypoxemic for sure, but their high cardiac output is compensating, preventing severe tissue hypoxia for now.
Okay.
Now, patient B comes in, their SpO2 is 96%, looks totally fine on the monitor, but you notice they're pale, their cap refill is slow, they're hypotensive, and you find out they're severely anemic.
So they have no carriers and no pressure.
Exactly. Despite the good saturation number, they are in profound tissue hypoxia because there aren't enough hemoglobin carriers or enough perfusion pressure to actually deliver that oxygen to the tissues.
So the lesson is you always have to assess the whole child. Check those peripheral perfusion markers, cap refill, mental status, skin color, not just the monitor. The tissue is what matters.
Absolutely. The goal of early PALS is to prevent that slide into tissue hypoxia, no matter what the initial pulse ox reading is, if that child is showing you signs of increased work of breathing or shock.
All right, let's pivot to the other side of the coin, hypercarbia, the ventilation impairment. You called it the quiet killer.
It really is. It's notoriously subtle at the beginning. Hypercarbia is just the buildup of carbon dioxide, the PaCO2, in the arterial blood. The lung's primary mechanical job is ventilation, the physical movement of air, to get rid of this metabolic waste product and keep our acid-base balance normal.
And if that ventilation fails, maybe from muscle weakness or a suppressed central drive or a really bad obstruction, the PaCO2 climbs and the child develops a respiratory acidosis.
Exactly. And unlike hypoxemia, which can give us those visual cues like dusky skin or an alarm on the pulse ox, hypercarbia doesn't have a reliable, early, obvious clinical sign. You can't see CO2 accumulating.
So for the ER nurse who's managing a child in distress, how do we catch ventilation failure quickly, before that definitive blood gas comes back from the lab?
This is such a critical point about non-invasive monitoring. While, you know, a decreased level of consciousness is a definitive sign of worsening hypercarbia and acidosis, it's often a late sign.
Too late.
It can be. This is why capnography, that's end-tidal CO2 monitoring, or ETCO2, is just absolutely crucial. In a spontaneously breathing child who has a relatively patent airway, ETCO2 gives you a near-instantaneous continuous reading of their ventilation effectiveness.
So the takeaway is we should be slapping an ETCO2 monitor on any pediatric patient who shows up with unexplained agitation or a sudden change in mental status, especially if it's in the context of respiratory distress.
Without a single doubt. If that ETCO2 is high, or if it suddenly starts to rise after a period where they were compensating, you have objective evidence of ventilation failure. You have worsening acidosis that requires immediate mechanical intervention, often before the hypoxemia even becomes severe enough to cause a cardiac crash.
Let's chart the course of deterioration then. Using that checklist from the source material, which maps the body's initial successful fight against hypoxemia and hypercarbia, and then its eventual inevitable collapse if we don't intervene.
Right. Let's walk through it.
First, the compensation phase. These are the early signs of tissue hypoxia.
In this phase, the autonomic nervous system is it's driving the response hard. The whole goal is to move oxygen faster and blow off CO2 more efficiently.
What are the cardinal signs of this early cardiopulmonary response? What do we see at the bedside?
First and foremost, tachypnea. They are breathing faster and often deeper.
Okay, fast rate.
Second, increased respiratory effort, all that muscle use we talked about, the retractions, the flaring, the grunting, which we'll get into more detail on later.
Right.
And third, driven by that adrenergic surge and the need to maintain circulation, they become tachycardic. The heart rate goes up.
And behaviorally, you can see it too. The child is fighting that feeling of air hunger and the acid building up.
Absolutely. They are agitated, anxious, or irritable. They're awake, they're responsive, but they're clearly struggling. This right here is your golden window for intervention. The prognosis is still excellent if you can figure out the underlying cause and reverse the failure.
And what about skin signs?
You might see some pallor or mottling. Frank's cyanosis is usually a later, more concerning sign, right, but you can start to see some poor perfusion early on.
Okay, now for the tipping point, the failure phase. The compensatory mechanisms fail, or the child just completely exhausts their muscle reserves. What does that system failure look like at the bedside?
The clinical picture just reverses completely. It's a total flip. Instead of fighting, the child starts to succumb to fatigue and the central nervous system depression from the severe acidosis and hypoxemia.
So that initial really fast respiratory rate gives way to
a slow respiratory rate, or even worse, apnea. The respiratory muscles are just fatigued. The central drive is suppressed. Instead of all that increased effort, we now see inadequate or decreased respiratory effort.
Like shallow breaths?
Shallow breaths, maybe some intermittent gasping, or you might see seesaw respirations where the chest and abdomen move in opposite directions. It's a sign of severely inefficient mechanics.
And what about the heart? This is the single most critical, urgent, and ominous vital sign change, right? The final warning before arrest.
It is. The cardiac status shifts from tachycardia to bradycardia. If a child who is tachycardic suddenly becomes profoundly bradycardic, you must recognize that the myocardium itself is severely hypoxic and it is failing. This is a pre-arrest state.
And it demands immediate, often invasive management.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Assisted ventilation, maybe even chest compressions, if the perfusion is that compromised. You have seconds, not minutes.
And coupled with this, of course, their consciousness plummets.
It does. They go from being agitated to lethargy, stupor, or unresponsiveness. This reflects severe hypoxia, maybe rising intracranial pressure, and critical acidosis. That transition from agitation to lethargy should trigger a red alert in any critical care setting.
Understanding that progression is vital, but understanding the root cause, the mechanism of why the oxygen saturation dropped in the first place, that's what dictates our specific therapy. Our source has defined four major physiological mechanisms. Let's walk through each one.
Okay, first up is alveolar hypoventilation.
So a problem with volume.
It's fundamentally a volume problem. The child just isn't moving enough air, what we call minute ventilation, into and out of the alveoli. This causes a buildup of CO2, which according to the gas laws, literally displaces oxygen within the alveoli. So the PaPO2 drops.
And the classic causes for this are things that suppress the respiratory drive centrally, right? Mm-hmm. In the brain.
Yes. Think of major CNS events, head trauma, an infection like meningitis or encephalitis, maybe a severe metabolic issue or a drug overdose.
Opioids.
Opioids are the classic example. They directly suppress those brainstem respiratory centers. The muscles are fine, the lungs are fine, but the drive to breathe is gone.
So the treatment rationale is obvious.
It is. You have to restore normal ventilation for them. This means assisted ventilation with a bag mask or intubation immediately, along with supplemental oxygen.
Okay, mechanism number two, the diffusion defect.
Here, the problem is that gas movement across the alveolar capillary membrane is impaired. That membrane becomes thickened or clogged, usually with fluid or inflammatory cells.
So the distance oxygen has to travel gets much longer.
Much longer, and it slows down gas exchange significantly. Mm-hmm. The causes here would be conditions like severe pulmonary edema or extensive interstitial pneumonia, where the lung tissue itself is what's compromised.
That's sick lung tissue.
Right. And the therapeutic challenge here is often reducing that fluid burden and helping to force oxygen across that thickened barrier. So we often rely on increasing the pressure to help push fluid out and maximize surface area.
Meaning things like CPAP or BiPAP.
Exactly. Non-invasive positive pressure ventilation combined with high concentrations of supplementary oxygen is key.
Okay, the third mechanism, and this is probably the most common one we see in severe pediatric lung disease, is the ventilation perfusion imbalance or VQ mismatch.
Right. This is a mismatch between the air going in, the V for ventilation, and the blood flowing past, the Q for perfusion. In most pediatric respiratory diseases, the problem is what we call low VQ.
So not enough air for the blood flow.
Right. You have blood flowing past alveoli that are either collapsed, that's atelectasis, or filled with fluid or pus, like in pneumonia, severe bronchiolitis, or asthma. It's essentially wasted perfusion because that blood goes by but leaves without getting oxygenated.
It acts like a physiological shunt.
It does. Blood that's entering the left side of the heart is still deoxygenated. If that VQ mismatch is severe, the child will have significant hypoxemia.
And the treatment strategy here is all about opening those alveoli back up.
It's all about alveolar recruitment. This is why positive end expiratory pressure, PEEP or CPAP, is a first-line intervention. It prevents the alveoli from collapsing at the end of expiration, which maximizes the surface area for gas exchange. And of course, you add supplementary oxygen.
Finally, the most structurally definitive mechanism, the right-to-left shunt.
This is an anatomical abnormality. It's where unoxygenated venous blood completely bypasses the pulmonary circulation. It travels through a structural defect like a BSD or a PDA in certain congenital heart diseases and returns directly to the systemic circulation without ever seeing the lungs.
And the treatment consequence here is so critical for the ER nurse to remember.
Yes. Supplementary oxygen by itself is almost always ineffective. It doesn't work.
Because the blood isn't going near the lungs.
Right. If the blood doesn't go near the lung, you can pour 100% oxygen into the airway. It's not going to help. These patients often remain severely cyanotic despite maximal oxygen delivery. The management requires specialized, definitive treatments specific to their cardiac defect, maybe prostaglandins, to keep a ductus open, depending on the lesion.
So really, understanding these four pathways gives the ER nurse the blueprint for initial therapy. If it's hyperventilation, you bag them. If it's VQ mismatch or a diffusion defect, you need PEEP or CPAP. And if it's a structural shunt, you need specialized cardiac management and FAS.
That's the framework. It guides everything.
Now let's connect those underlying mechanisms to the clinical presentation we actually see at the bedside. PLS classifies respiratory problems into four major categories based on where the primary obstruction or pathology is. Because identifying the type is what dictates your initial targeted drug or pressure intervention.
Exactly. Let's start at the top.
Upper airway obstruction, or UAO.
UAO occurs anywhere above the thoracic inlet. So the nose, the pharynx, the larynx, or the upper trachea. In children, and especially infants, these structures are proportionally so much smaller and more compliant, which makes them highly susceptible to obstruction from inflammation or a foreign body.
And the pathophysiology is all about resistance to airflow during.
Inspiration. The obstruction acts like this restrictive bottleneck. Air has to rush in turbulently against that resistance.
And that turbulent inspiratory flow creates the classic sound.
Inspiratory stridor. When you hear that, you know where the problem is. Other signs might include a barking cough, like in croup, or hoarseness if there's laryngeal involvement. You'll see the child's effort is just dramatically increased as they try to generate this powerful negative intrathoracic pressure to pull air past whatever's blocking the way.
So if I walk into a trauma bay and I hear inspiratory stridor, my brain should immediately categorize this as UAO. My differential diagnosis then includes croup, maybe a foreign body, anaphylaxis, or epiglottitis, and my immediate nursing priority shifts to targeted edema reduction.
Precisely. Your intervention might be humidified blow by oxygen, maybe racemic epinephrine to shrink that edema, or possibly even Heliox to try and improve laminar flow. And the sources all emphasize minimal stimulation for these kids because making them cry and get agitated can actually worsen the obstruction.
Don't make it worse. Okay, let's move down the respiratory tract to lower airway obstruction, LAO. This is happening in the bronchi. The bronchial is the lower trachea. So we're thinking asthma, severe bronchiolitis. How does the pathophysiology change here?
Here, the obstruction is actually worse upon expiration. The mechanism is different. It's bronchospasm, mucus plugging, and inflammation deep inside the small airways. And the crucial dynamic to understand is air trapping.
Why is expiration the big issue here?
Well, during normal expiration, the lungs just passively recoil. But during a forced expiration, which a distressed child has to do, the intrathoracic pressure increases dramatically. This pressure actually compresses those already narrow, inflamed small airways, causing this sort of check valve effect.
So air gets in, but it can't get out.
It can't get out efficiently. This air trapping leads to hyperinflation. You can see it on an x-ray sometimes, a flattened diaphragms.
And the clinical signs, the sounds we hear, are the hallmark of this expiratory struggle.
It's wheezing. That high-pitched sound on expiration, reflecting air being squeezed past these narrowed passages. If the LAO gets really severe, the wheezing might become biphasic. You'll hear it on inspiration and expiration, or even more ominously, the chest can become silent.
A silent chest is a bad sign.
A silent chest is a terrible sign. It indicates such profound air trapping and fatigue that very little air is moving at all. So your treatment is directed at relieving that bronchospasm and inflammation, primarily with bronchodilators like albuterol and, of course, steroids.
This brings us to that profound, nice-to-know clinical pearl about the physics of small airways, which absolutely grounds the urgency of treating LAO in infants.
This is the moment where the pathophysiology just becomes terrifyingly real. You have to appreciate that airway resistance is governed by the radius the airway lumen raised to a power. It's not a linear relationship. When airflow is laminar quiet and smooth, resistance is inversely proportional to the radius of the fourth power. When it's turbulent, fast, and distressed, it's the fifth power.
Okay, let's use the source's calculation for maximum clinical impact. Imagine an infant's airway. It's already tiny, maybe 4 millimeters in diameter.
Right. Now, if that infant develops just 1 millimeter of circumferential edema or inflammation, which is so easy to get in severe bronchiolitis or croup, the airway lumen is reduced from 4 millimeters down to 2 millimeters. That tiny change means the cross-sectional area of their airway is reduced by 75%.
A huge reduction. But because resistance scales exponentially, how much harder does that make breathing?
The resistance increases by a factor of 2^4. That's a 16-fold increase.
16 times.
A 1 millimeter change in an infant results in a 16 times harder breathing effort. Now compare that to an adult with an 8 millimeter airway. That same 1 millimeter edema shrinks their airway by about 2 millimeters total, so the lumen is 6 millimeters, but the resistance increase is only about 3-fold.
That one calculation, 16 times harder, is the justification for why an infant in respiratory distress can fatigue and crash so incredibly fast, often within hours. Their entire system is being taxed at 16 times the normal rate.
And it also explains why that increased effort creates more turbulent flow, which in turn increases resistance even further. It sets up this catastrophic spiral toward fatigue. This urgency has to drive the ER nurse's immediate action plan.
Okay, moving to the substance of the lung itself, lung tissue disease. This category includes pneumonia, severe pulmonary edema, maybe from heart failure or ARDS. What's the fundamental problem here?
The fundamental problem is decreased lung compliance. The lungs become stiff, heavy, and inelastic because they're full of fluid or pus or inflammatory gunk filling the interstitial space or the alveoli.
So it takes a ton of pressure to inflate them.
It takes massive pressure to expand these lungs and get an adequate tidal volume. This instantly causes a VQ mismatch and diffusion defects.
And the clinical signs are going to reflect that stiffness and that fluid?
Absolutely. When you listen with your stethoscope, you're going to hear crackles, which indicates fluid in the alveoli, and often diminished breath sounds because there's just poor air movement. And because of the VQ mismatch, these children typically exhibit hypoxemia that is resistant to supplementary oxygen.
So you put them on a non-rebreather at 15 liters and their sat doesn't budge.
It barely moves. You can give them 100% O2, but if the alveoli are filled with pus, it won't matter.
And there's one really unique high-yield clinical compensatory sign in this group, grunting. Tell us why grunting is such a critical indicator of severe lung tissue disease.
Grunting is a fascinating compensatory mechanism. The distressed child is using it to create their own continuous positive airway pressure. They're making their own auto peep.
How do they do that?
They intentionally exhale against a partially closed glottis. This maneuver maintains pressure in the alveoli at the end of expiration, and it prevents those stiff, fluid-filled alveoli from collapsing completely. It maximizes the time available for gas exchange to happen.
So if you hear a grunt, it means that child is actively, desperately trying to maintain their own alveolar patency. It confirms they have severe lung tissue compliance issues.
It is a sign of a massive physiological struggle. And therefore, our therapeutic intervention is often to assist that mechanism by applying external PEEP or CPAP with non-invasive ventilation to help recruit those stiff lung units. And then, of course, supportive care like diuretics for edema or antibiotics for pneumonia.
All right, our final category, disordered control of breathing. The hardware, the lungs and airways, might be structurally okay, but the software, the central drive, is failing.
This is an impaired central nervous system control issue. It's a problem of inadequate ventilation driven by issues in the brainstem. It's often caused by neurologic events like seizures and intracranial hemorrhage or a post-ictal state.
But it could also be metabolic, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Severe metabolic abnormalities like hypoglycemia or toxins or the classic one again, a sedative or narcotic drug overdose.
Since the central drive is what's failing, the clinical signs are going to be focused on an abnormal rate and depth, not necessarily effort or sound.
Correct. You're going to see variable or irregular respiratory patterns, things like central apnea or periods of rapid shallow breathing that alternate with pauses. Critically, the breathing is often very slow and shallow with just grossly inadequate effort. This leads rapidly to hypoventilation, hypercarbia, and then the subsequent acidosis.
For the ER nurse, what's the initial definitive clinical sign that should point you immediately toward this diagnosis, especially before you have blood gases back?
It's the profound decreased level of consciousness. While agitation can be an early sign of hypoxia in other categories, a rapid progression to lethargy or unresponsiveness, especially when paired with a slow, shallow respiratory pattern, points very strongly toward central hypoventilation and rising PACO2.
So the treatment is totally different.
Completely. Unlike the other categories where you're primarily treating the airway or the lung, here you have to treat the drive. And that means immediate, aggressive, assisted ventilation to maintain gas exchange until you can figure out and reverse the underlying CNS or metabolic issue.
Okay, we've built the entire physiological framework. Now let's put it all together. For the ER nurse at the bedside, the goal is rapid, continuous assessment using those four parameters we've discussed, patency and effort, rate, heart rate, and consciousness, to determine both the problem type and its severity.
You have to move rapidly through this classification at the bedside. Step one, airway patency and effort. What do I hear? Do I hear stridor?
UAO.
Exactly. Do I hear wheezing?
LAO.
Do I hear grunting and crackle?
Right, tissue disease.
Right. And then you ask, is the effort strong? That's distress. Or is it absent or weak? That's failure.
So that first step instantly categorizes the problem, and it dictates your immediate mechanical intervention like suctioning, positioning, or applying positive pressure.
Step two is rate in depth. Is the child tachypneic? Are they compensating? Or are they bradypneic? Are they failing? Bradypnea, especially if it's shallow, suggests either profound fatigue or that disordered control of breathing.
Step three, cardiac status.
Tachycardia is a compensatory sign. We expect that. But bradycardia, that sudden persistent drop, that is the pre-arrest signal of myocardial hypoxia.
And finally, step four, level of consciousness.
Agitation is early. Lethargy or unresponsiveness is late, and that often signals critical hypercarbia and acidosis.
Okay, let's connect the dots now. Let's run through a few quick scenarios to show how these specific sign combinations point you directly to a diagnosis. I see an infant who is tachypneic, mildly tachycardic, but has clear inspiratory stridor and is otherwise alert, though fussy.
That is respiratory distress due to an upper airway obstruction, most likely croup. Your intervention is targeted at relieving that inspiratory resistance. Racemic epi, maybe some steroids.
Okay. I see a toddler who is bradypneic, lethargic, and has very shallow respirations. Heart sounds are normal, but there's a known history of a seizure disorder. Or maybe mom says they might have gotten into her pills.
That is respiratory failure due to disordered control of breathing. The urgency there is to immediately support their ventilation with a bag mask. It's not about giving bronchodilators. You have to breathe for them.
Right. Wrong treatment for the wrong problem. Last one. I see a child who is tachypneic, has bilateral crackles on auscultation, is grunting intensely, and is hypoxemic despite being on a 100% non-rebreather mask. Their heart rate is still fast, though.
That is respiratory distress that is bordering on failure due to lung tissue disease, probably a bad pneumonia or pulmonary edema. The top priority there is getting PEEP or CPAP on them to recruit those alveoli and try to correct that VQ mismatch.
We have to keep reiterating that most high-quality PALS interventions are aimed at interrupting this progression before the cardiac collapse. Let's just focus one last time on those absolute clinical changes that define the transition from distress to failure.
This transition point is where the provider has to shift their entire mindset from supportive care to aggressive, often invasive, intervention-assisted ventilation, intubation, massive pressure support.
Okay, transition one, the exhaustion of the work of breathing. We move from that frantic, increased effort, the attractions, the flaring.
To decreased or absent effort, the child just stops fighting. That's a terrible sign.
Transition two, the exhaustion of the respiratory rate, the movement from that compensatory tachypnea.
The ominous slowing of the rate, bradypnea, and ultimately apnea. I would say bradypnea is often more terrifying than severe tachypnea because it means the child is truly given up.
Transition three, the ultimate sign of organ failure, the drop in cardiac status. We move from compensatory tachycardia
to system collapse, which is signaled by bradycardia. That is the absolute pre-arrest moment. If you see that, you are seconds away from compressions.
And finally, transition four, the central neurological collapse. The child moves from anxiety and agitation, which is a sign of CNS engagement,
to profound lethargy or unresponsiveness, which is often driven by that rising CO2 and acidosis poisoning the brain.
What's really fascinating about this approach is that it forces the ER nurse to be a true diagnostician, not just a procedure technician. You have to recognize these four respiratory patterns and the physiological status compensated versus failed to dictate the specific treatment pathway.
You have to. If you fail to classify the problem type early on, you risk applying the wrong pressure or the wrong medication, which can often worsen the underlying pathology. For example, giving aggressive fluid resuscitation to a child with primary pulmonary edema could be devastating. Payless is about precision driven by pathology.
This deep dive really solidifies the central principle of PALE. Pediatric resuscitation is, first and foremost, respiratory resuscitation. Your success hinges on the rapid, accurate classification of the problem, upper airway obstruction, lower airway obstruction, lung tissue disease, or disordered control, and intervening decisively before that child fatigues.
That classification is your operational blueprint. If you identify lung tissue disease, you're thinking about maximizing PEEP. If you identify UAO, you're reaching for nebulized epinephrine. If you identify disordered control, you are bagging them. Knowing the clinical why for each of those steps is what provides the confidence you need for rapid high-stakes decision-making.
And translating this knowledge to the high-pressure environment of the trauma bay or the pediatric ICU, understanding the physics, that 1 millimeter of edema in an infant creates 16 times the resistance, that provides the clinical urgency. It explains why you cannot afford to wait even a few minutes to initiate targeted therapy for what might, on the surface, look like just a mild cough.
Absolutely. The most successful codes are always the ones you prevented from ever happening. Your mastery of this respiratory phase is the single most valuable skill you possess in pediatric care.
Now, as we wrap up, we've discussed how difficult it can be to detect hypercarbia clinically. The early signs like cyanosis are often absent, and a decreased level of consciousness is a late marker. We established that an ER nurse should not and cannot wait for an arterial blood gas to confirm inadequate ventilation.
No, time is just too precious for that.
So given the constraints of the acute care setting, when you are faced with a pediatric patient who is showing that very worrying shift from agitation to lethargy, what single piece of non-invasive monitoring technology should immediately be prioritized to confirm inadequate ventilation and guide your decision to intubate or assist their breathing?
Capnography. Specifically, the continuous end-tidal CO2 monitor. It is your immediate real-time window into that child's ventilation status and their acid-base balance.
The ultimate tool for preventing that secondary cardiac arrest. Thank you for joining us on this critical deep dive into the foundational respiratory elements of PELS.
Stay sharp out there and use that physics knowledge to save a life.